Hello and welcome to PaleoCast. My name's Dave Marshall.
And I'm Joe Keating.
And this is our first episode.
So how are you, Dave?
I'm alright. I'm pretty excited that we've actually got this together.
Yeah, definitely. So who are we talking to this week?
Well, I am talking to Layla Battison, who is of Oxford University and is also working at NASA at the moment.
Okay, fantastic. And what are you talking about?
We're talking about the early origins of life and also the NASA mission to Mars. I don't know if you've seen any of that on the telly.
Oh yeah, I saw a fantastic video the other day of the HD landing of the Curiosity rover. It was absolutely spectacular. And just at the end of the video, you can see the heat shield actually hitting the surface of the planet. Amazing.
Well, we discussed the fossil record of the earliest life on Earth and how this information can be used to help with the search of evidence of similar life on other planets.
Well, that sounds out of this world, Dave.
You cheesy... A signal confirming that NASA's Curiosity rover, also known as the Mars Science Laboratory, or MSL, had landed on Mars was received at Mission Control in the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Los Angeles, at 5:32 Greenwich Mean Time on Monday the 6th of August. The robot rover landed close to Mars's equator in a large depression called Gale's Crater, close to the 5-kilometer-high Mount Sharp, where it is to conduct its investigations over the coming years. Here to talk to us today about the Mars rover and the early origins of life is Layla Battison. So thanks for joining us, Layla.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Could you tell us a bit about yourself and how you got into the origins of early life?
Sure. Well, I have just finished a PhD at Oxford. I was looking at paleontology and all the exciting stuff's already been, all of the stuff that's... easy to see has already been done in the Phanerozoic. So I was pushing stuff back further and further back in time. And in the end, you start looking at the origin of life.
So where are you now?
So I'm at NASA at the moment, and I have just been witness to this wonderful landing. It was quite some celebration here. There were about 10,000 people at NASA Ames in Northern California. You should have heard the shouts when the lander touched down in one piece, which was quite a relief.
So that was outside of the mission control. There was just 10,000 people. Were you all gathered together in front of a big screen?
Sure, yeah. This was at NASA Ames. They put a big screen outside, and 10,000 people just screamed their heads off when that thing came down. Yeah.
So what is it you're actually doing at NASA at the moment?
So I'm working with the exobiology branch. I'm trying to work out how biology responds in sort of geological situations. I'm seeing how fossils can be preserved from living bacteria to layered stromatolites and things like that. And hopefully that'll give us clues about understanding the early Earth and also looking for life on other planets like the Curiosity rover may be doing in the future.
Yeah, so in the news reports, it's a picture painted of Curiosity roaming the surface looking at rocks for signs that Mars once had life. So is it that they're actually looking for these kind of similar things that you're looking at there, so the stromatolites and ancient fossils?
Well, I think that would be quite hopeful to be looking for fossils. What the mission is to actually look for habitable areas. So what they're looking for is rocks that show signs that there was once water, so you could have hosted life. We know that life exists in water today. We know that fossils are found in ancient watery environments. So what Curiosity is going to do is look for ancient watery environments on Mars. And then once we find those, we should be able to look at them closely to see if there are any signs of ancient or possibly even still existing life.
Well, how would you know what it would look like if it is on another planet? what's to say that it's the same as the kind of life we get on Earth?
That's a very complicated question, but you can... So we use the fossil record of life on Earth to try and work out what has happened in the past. Obviously, life on Mars isn't going to look like life today on Earth, because at some point along the way, it pretty much died out. You don't get water on Mars. So you've got to trace back to a time when Earth and Mars were kind of similar. And in the ancient Earth, you are looking at sort of bacterial environments where microbes ruled. So we can look at the fossil record on Earth to sort of see what we might expect if we went back to that similar time when Mars had water, to look for the fossil record on Mars.
Well, I think it is worth our while sending these rovers to look at the surface, but it isn't the only way that we've been able to study these Martian rocks. And so every year, meteorites land on Earth, and of the 50,000 odd meteorites that have actually been recovered and identified, there's about 100 of them that we think have actually originated from Mars. And famously, the Allen Hills 84001 meteorite, which was found in Antarctica, is believed to have been ejected from the Martian surface during a collision. And on this meteorite, there appear to be kind of what's thought to be nanobacteria, or what looks like it. So is it possible that these structures are biological in origin and that we already have our answer already?
I think the short answer to that is no, but the long answer is a lot more complicated. So ALH 84001, you can see I've been working with it for a while because I can say it faster than you. ALH 84001 caused a big stir in the 90s because they found these fossils. So they looked at them with scanning electron microscopy, and they found these things that looked like rod-shaped bacteria on the surface. And the scientists were really excited, and they say, wow, we've got nanobacteria. But even that wouldn't have been enough, and they found other signs that they could have been living, things like mineral deposits that they thought were formed by bacteria, and sort of iron particles that we know that bacteria can concentrate. So they sort of drew together a few different lines of evidence to suggest that the ALH 84001 actually had Martian life, or at least fossils of Martian life. So since then, though, each of those individual pieces of evidence have been put under a bit more scrutiny, and one by one they've sort of come tumbling down. They've shown that the mineral deposits need not have been concentrated specifically by bacteria. They could form just by physical processes, so you don't need life to form those. They've shown that the iron particles aren't that important. You can get those without bacteria again. And the actual shapes that they found, when you look closer at the mineral surface of the meteorite, you actually see that it's crystal edges that are poking through the overall surface that are giving this kind of rod shape like a bacteria. And also there's some question about the size of them. You said nanobacteria, and they're the smallest things that could have ever been considered a bacteria. And when you get down to something that small, you are actually concerned about what you can fit into a space that small, whether you can fit all of the machinery of life into a cell that small. So one by one, all of these pieces of evidence have come tumbling down, and I think it's the general consensus now that it's not acceptable. Actually, just studying Martian meteorites is problematic in itself, because you have no idea where they've come from. You don't know what sort of extreme conditions they've been through on their journey to Earth and their landing on Earth. And obviously, a lot of these meteorites aren't picked up straight away. They're found in Antarctica, where they're easy to spot because they're black and white. So any sort of thing could have happened in the meantime. They could have been colonized by Earth's bacteria, for instance. So, we should still be spending the billions of dollars to send rovers to Mars, because it's our best bet of finding stuff.
There's still the theory that life could have originated on a different planet or somewhere else in the universe and was brought to Earth. How does that weigh up?
Well, it's a sexy idea. The panspermia hypothesis is something that people always sort of think that it's really sci-fi, you know, you've got some alien life reigning in on Earth. But when you look down at the bones of it, there's not a great deal of evidence. We have one data point for life, and that is Earth. You know, we have only found life on Earth so far. So we're pretty happy to say that there is life on Earth. And given that there is life on Earth now, it probably started on Earth. You could turn around and say it started somewhere else and came to Earth. But in that case, you have to answer questions like, why isn't it on any of the other planets? Even sort of faintly habitable planets, planetary bodies like Jupiter's moon Europa, that's got water ice on the surface. So we don't see abundant life like there is on Earth yet. So you need to answer the question of where is it coming from in order to just have, colonize Earth. And also, if you're displacing the origin of life to somewhere that you don't know, you've got to answer questions about completely different environments. You know, it could have been a sulfurous world or something really hellish. In that case, why would it have been suitable for colonizing Earth? So panspermia is sexy, but it's something that we've got no evidence for. But people still search, and there are life-like molecules out there in space. There's amino acids and nucleic acids that have been found just floating around randomly in space. But an amino acid is not enough by itself to make life.
So those are compounds that life actually uses, but they don't have to be created by organisms to exist.
Well, that's sort of a bit of an old piece of research that showed that, you know, these are the basics for life. You know, you need amino acids, you need nucleic acids, you need a bunch of stuff just coming together and working together in a really complex system. But some of those basic building blocks of life, they call them, are actually able to be formed in completely physical environments, completely abiogenic environments. So there was a famous experiment last century by Stanley Miller and his supervisor, Harold Urey, and they electrified a warm, soupy broth of nitrates and ammonias and things like that. And they actually put electric sparks through these and managed to synthesize some of these building blocks of life. So that's one step towards life, but it's a lot more complicated than that. So we know that with enough energy we can make the building blocks, but we need more to actually make life.
So if life is believed to have been able to originate on this planet independently, is there evidence for more than one origin?
When you get down that far, it's really difficult to tell. The fact that all of life is made up of DNA, DNA and RNA and proteins that make use of 20 specific amino acids is probably really good evidence that there was one successful origin of life that sort of survived all the way through to diversify to become all of the life that we see today. We've never seen anything on Earth that doesn't have DNA. So we know that at some point everything stemmed back to this one universal common ancestor. And that was a DNA-using, protein-building organism.
I was just thinking, though, that that theory that they all have DNA, couldn't that be just because they all had the amino acids available to them? Is it possible that life would be able to use something else, or can it only use amino acids?
It is possible that a life system could use other things than we know that exists. So life actually only makes use of a small group of amino acids and a very specific few structures of nucleic acids to build its DNA. And it is there are other ones out there that it could make use of. So the fact that it's chosen specific molecules, specific compounds, and also specific shapes of those compounds is some kind of indication that it has chosen, life, it didn't consciously choose it, but life has gone down one route since you know, the earliest forms of cells, and it hasn't really changed that replication system or building system since then.
Have any other molecules been shown to be able to self-replicate?
Oh, I don't know. Probably so, but that's for the synthetic chemists.
What is the earliest life we see in the fossil record, and what form does it take?
Okay, so the fossil record is a funny thing. It's very biased, and it takes a lot of special conditions to come together to preserve something, something that's soft-bodied or something that's very easily decayed. And it's quite likely that the earliest forms of life, these very early single-celled bacterial organisms, were very easy to decay. They would have come into life and then they would have exploded or imploded, or, you know, they would have easily, very easily decayed. So first signs of life we see are some very simple spherical fossils 3.4 billion years ago from Australia. And they're found in cherts, so like silica-rich rocks just trapped within, sort of surrounded all around, on all sides by silica that would have formed very quickly. And you can see the spherical shape picked out in carbon. And those rocks are supposed, those rocks are thought to have come from sort of a beach-like environment, something that's a bit more, you know, shallow, something like you might find on a rocky beach today.
What was it, 3.4 billion years ago, did you say?
Yeah, 3.4 billion years ago. So the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. So it's almost a whole billion years, 1,000 million years after the beginning, the origin of our planet itself.
Mm-hmm. But that's still 3 billion years of life then.
Yep. It's done quite a lot since then.
Well, it hasn't. Has it done a lot in between 3.4 billion years and the half a billion years when we actually see the first multicellular life come in, the life as we more recognise it?
Yeah, life has, it's done a lot in 3.5 billion years, but it hasn't done it sort of equally on all timescales. So the earliest forms of life were bacteria. They stuck around for quite a long time. Probably the earliest bacteria didn't like oxygen. They, you know, they shied away. They probably made all of their energy from chemically synthesizing carbon, and no oxygen or light was involved in the processes. So the next step was to get oxygenation, so photosynthesis going. And that was a big step because they could make use of light and the gases in the air to make the stuff that they needed. So then the next step was eukaryotes, and that didn't come till much later, till about a billion years ago.
What's a eukaryote?
A eukaryote is what they call complex cells. We are all eukaryotes. You're a eukaryote, I'm a eukaryote, my cat is a eukaryote. All the plants that you see are eukaryotes. Every tree is a eukaryote.
Would it be easier to say what isn't a eukaryote then?
A prokaryote is not a eukaryote.
So the bacteria?
Bacteria are not eukaryotes. So eukaryotes were this big step that allowed everything that we can see today pretty much to start getting going. Biologically speaking, it's something with a nucleus inside its cell. So bacteria have just got their genetic material rattling around loose in the cell, whereas eukaryotes they've put all of their DNA inside a nucleus, which has got a membrane around it. And there's also other kinds of machinery inside eukaryotic cells that allow you to replicate things more efficiently, move stuff around more efficiently. It's all around just sort of like an upgrade on the cell, a complete engineering upgrade on the cell. So that was a really big change in life, and it was a really complicated thing to happen. And so we think that it probably took about a billion years to happen.
So that was, that'd be 2.5 billion years ago.
Yeah, well, we start to see these photosynthetic bacteria, cyanobacteria, about 2.5 billion years ago. And then between 2 billion years ago and 1 billion years ago, for like that whole billion years. They call it the boring billion because very little happened. In terms of climate change or continents moving around, everything kind of just sat still for a billion years. And that was really important because eukaryotes are thought to have... this is a really sort of groundbreaking theory by a late scientist called Lynn Margulis. She came up with this maverick theory that these complex eukaryotic cells didn't just evolve their complex machinery, but they borrowed it from other bacteria. And the two different types of bacteria lived together in kind of harmony, in a symbiosis, each providing something that the other needed for long enough that eventually their reproduction became synchronized and they became a single cell. So this is the Lynn Margulis' idea of endosymbiosis. And it's a really complicated process. And you can imagine if you're living, you know, with somebody and then something else changes to change how your harmony between you, it's gonna really mess up what's going on. So the boring billion was really important for endosymbiosis to actually just get fixed in for long enough. You know, they're doing it for long enough together, so it can work for long enough together, if that makes sense.
Is that the same kind of thing as mitochondria?
Yeah, sure. So mitochondria is a machinery that must respire oxygen and produce energy for every eukaryotic cell, not just animals or plants. And they are thought to be borrowed from a kind of bacteria called a purple bacteria. That was really good at doing that one thing. And so the earliest eukaryotic cell, or the proto-eukaryotic cell, borrowed this purple bacterium to provide the energy. Presumably that proto-eukaryotic cell could also give something back to the purple bacterium, you know, safety from predation or some nutrients that it needed. And so the two have worked together for long enough that it now is called the mitochondrion. And we've got evidence for that in the fact that mitochondria have still got their own kind of DNA that is completely separate from the rest of the cell.
So we're full of purple bacteria, in effect.
We are full of purple bacteria. It's a wonder we're not purple ourselves.
Are they purple?
What, purple bacteria?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're sort of pinky purple, yeah. You can find them at the bottom of any kind of nasty sulfur-smelling marsh. If you, like, put your foot through, it'll be black underneath, but just before the black finishes, there'll be a layer of pink, and those are purple. Purple sulfate-reducing bacteria. Yeah, go out and try it.
They're our distant, distant relatives.
Yeah, they're distant cousins. Yeah, yeah. We're related to them. We've got them inside us. And so the chloroplasts inside plant cells are another kind of symbiosis. So they've taken those early photosynthesizing cyanobacteria and incorporated them into the cell to make chloroplasts, which are really good at taking carbon dioxide and water and using light to make the oxygen. So plants have actually got twice the amount of symbiosis as we do. So you could say that they're more advanced than we are.
You said that some of the earliest life was found in a kind of beach environment. So what can the geology of the rocks that life is found in tell us about the environments or conditions that life needs in order to come into existence?
Sure. Well, we know that life today needs water. Pretty much everywhere on the Earth today, we find that there is water, we find life in some form. So that is one requirement that we need for life. But when we're looking at the origin of life, there's a couple of theories that have come up based on this kind of bottom-up approach of saying, okay, well, we need to make replication machinery, we need to make proteins, and we need to make cells. What kind of environment can all of that happen at once? So there's a few different theories. We find these fossils in a beach-like environment. So that's suggesting that life might have originated or life might have first thrived in a kind of low-pressure, relatively low-temperature environment where you've got an interchange between water, air, and maybe even the rock of a shoreline. So there's an idea there that is Darwin's old idea of a warm little pond where you've got these DNA swimming around and then frothy bubbles that they can get in with lipids that can actually form that sort of first cell. That's not been thought of much since, because the froth on the surface of an ocean doesn't last really long enough to let cells get to stabilize. But a new theory by Martin Brasier is that floating rafts of volcanic pumice, which is really bubbly, they can float around for tens of thousands of years. And if you've got the DNA from the surface of the... if you've got DNA sort of on that surface, then you can get the DNA in the bubbles of the pumice and then line it with lipids, and then all it takes is for the cells to escape themselves. So that's a new idea that scientists are just beginning to test. One of the old ideas is that life, in fact, originated deeper in the ocean in these black smokers, so these big black smoking chimneys that you get, and spreading ridges where two plates are moving apart. So these are really hot environments where seawater goes down through the ocean ridge and then it circulates through the crust and then comes back up. And it comes out black because it's rich in minerals and dissolved things and particulate things. And so the big theory, what happens if you go down to these smokers, is that you find they're covered in life. It's completely black down there and you wouldn't think that anything would be able to survive, but they're covered in worms and crabs and all sorts of things. And the life there is living off, instead of living off sunlight, it's living off the chemicals that are coming out of the black smokers. So there's this long-standing opinion that the earliest life would be able to make use of that, those chemicals coming out of the black smokers. Instead of using sunlight to get its energy, instead they were getting energy from the heat of the smoker and from the chemical reactions that were going on there. And you also have cell-like environments down there with sort of minerals forming these hollow spheres that you could once again get lipids in. So there's these two kind of contesting theories. At the moment, we've got some geological evidence from both of them, but we're going to need some more information before we're going to be able to resolve anything further than that.
Do we get bacterial activity in the black smokers? Because the examples that you gave, the worms and crabs and everything that live there, would have had their origins further up and then have later moved down to the black smokers. So do you get the bacteria?
Yeah, sorry. So yeah, those examples are derived, but it shows that that kind of metabolism is possible. You do get bacteria, so you get these, they're called chemotrophic bacteria, and they're some of the more primitive bacteria. So if you actually, if you look at all of the evolutionary relationships between bacteria, and you can do that by analyzing their DNA and putting them into like a evolutionary tree, right at the bottom you've got some of these earliest bacteria, and you find that their relatives are these chemotrophic ones that are using the chemicals and nutrients to get their energy rather than sunlight or anything else. So there are bacteria there now, and they are some of the oldest bacteria that we can that are still existing today on Earth.
The earliest fossils you get, you said, were small balls. Can you be sure that these are actually fossils and not inorganic minerals? How are you actually able to tell, put your finger on it and say, that's a fossil and not anything else?
Sure. Well, that's the question that's kept me in a job for the last 4 years. It's really difficult to tell, because if you just look at it, it looks like a ball. There's not, you know, especially with these really early ones, there's not much to look at them. If you've ever seen a bacteria down a microscope, you can say that it's round or it's rod-shaped, but there's not much else that you can see on its surface. So proving that something that you see in the rock record is in actual fact a fossil of something that was once living is very complicated, and you've got to use lots of different kinds of evidence to support that interpretation. So first of all, you need to prove that whatever you're looking at actually belongs in the rock and it hasn't come in later, because contamination is a really big problem. If you've collected a rock and put it in your lab bench for a while, some, you know, mouse bacteria might get on it. So we do that by actually trying to look at fossils that are sealed within a rock. So these earliest fossils are found in silica, and you actually take a paper thin slice of the rock, look at it down a microscope, and you can see these spheres, and they're completely surrounded by silica. So you know that there is no way that they could have got in at any later date, because that you can date the rocks that are surrounding them, and you can say that these rocks are 3.5 billion years old. The rock, the fossils, the structures that are in them that you are interpreting as fossils must be 3.5 billion years old as well. So the next stage is then to prove that they were once living. So in that case, you want as many different pieces of information that can tell you that it was once living. So shape is just one of them. It's easier when you get to more complex eukaryotic cells, and especially metazoans and animals and things like that, because, you know, if you have a shape like a giraffe, you know that physical processes probably wouldn't be able to produce that shape all by itself. But when you're going down to something as simple as bacteria, physical processes like mineralization and recrystallization of rocks can sort of concentrate carbon and move things around to create these shapes that are very suggestive of life. So it's quite easy to trip up on just shape. So what you need to do is take other things. You can look at the shapes at very high resolution and look inside these cells to see if anything inside the cells is preserved. So any kind of internal structure is probably good indication that something other than just physics and chemistry was going on. And then you can look at other fossil, we call them biomarkers, things like molecules that have been fossilized along with those rocks that could have only been produced by life. So our cells produce steroids and certain molecules like that, and those can be fossilized and those can be identified. And if you find a fossil steroid with a fossil with a fossil structure, then you can probably say that it was life. You can also look for specific things that life does to the minerals, like leaching out the stuff that it wants, the nutrients that it wants, and leaving behind sort of these depleted rocks, or making layered structures. There's loads of different things that you can look at, and you've got to kind of build this tower of cards to support your idea that these things are in fact fossils. And the further back you go in time, the more difficult it is, but we do our best.
How rare are these kind of fossils then? Do you spend quite a long time, I imagine, looking for them?
They are tricky to find the right kind of places where they're preserved. So as I said before, they are... it's very difficult to preserve something as delicate as a bacterial cell. So you need to look for the right kinds of geological conditions to preserve these things. But once you've got those conditions and you're in the right kind of time frame, it is surprisingly simple. If you've got the right kind of rock and you know that, you know, this was a habitable environment and things could have thrived there, then all you need to do is crack open a rock and take a section, and some of my samples would be just chock full. You could barely see the rock for the fossils. They would be absolutely crammed in. And so as long as you find the right space, you know, the right place and time, then they're not actually that rare at all. The great thing about microfossils is that they're so small, so you can fit billions in a tiny space. So you're not looking for one big dinosaur bone in the whole of America. You're looking for lots of different fossils in, you know, a square foot. So they're not as rare as you might think, but obviously as you go further back in time, they get more difficult to find, because you're not exactly sure what is the right kind of environment, and you're not exactly sure when it actually appeared, so when you're expecting to see these fossils.
The rocks on Earth are always being recycled, so how rare is it to actually find some rocks that are old enough to have this life in it?
Sure, relatively rare. So the oceanic crust, I think the oldest oceanic crust is something like 170 million years old. So we're talking about things that are at least 10 times older. There are rocks that old around, you know, but they are usually ones that have been contained in the big, stable continental regions. So you can go into the center of Russia, and that's loads and loads of deep Precambrian rocks, or the Canadian sort of continental area. That's got loads of really old continental rocks. So they're not as common as any other kind of rock, but that what is good is that when you find them, they usually have been sitting there for a long time without being, you know, moved around or cracked up. They might have been metamorphosed, but a lot of Precambrian rocks have only been seriously metamorphosed just once or twice. So you can have a good look at these things and say something about the geological environment that they came from, the deposition environment that they came from, and the kind of habitable environment there was for the life that was living there.
So when they get metamorphosed, that's heat and pressure changing all the minerals in the rock, isn't it?
Yeah, so metamorphism is a bad thing if you're looking for microfossils, because obviously when you cook and pressurize a rock, it's going to change all the mineral structures and everything's going to recrystallize. It might even be partially melted. If you've got these tiny little carbon-based bacterial fossils, they're just going to get cooked along with everything else. And if you get any kind of sort of pressure, these things are going to get squashed and you're going to lose the shape that you had. And if you cook it too hard, then you're going to lose any chemical signals that go along with it as well. So when we're looking for early life, you're looking for the least metamorphosed things that you possibly can. And luckily there are a few, but yeah, you have to be quite careful about that.
Do we have rocks that go all the way back to the origin of the Earth?
So the origin of the Earth was a nasty time. It was hell. It was all molten, molten exploding volcanoes, and eventually the land started to cool and continents started to form, and water was probably delivered to the Earth by asteroid and cometary impact. So that was probably around sort of 4.2 to 4 billion years ago. So that's when we've got our oldest rocks that we start to see. And so we can see igneous rocks from that time, and obviously metamorphosed igneous rocks from that time. Sedimentary rocks are a little bit later, because you need to get a sedimentary rock, you obviously need a water cycle to start processing these rocks. They need to get eroded and redeposited, probably in a watery environment. So the oldest sedimentary rocks are around 4 billion years old. So a fair age, but not right back to the very beginning.
Do you think we'll be able to find life in any of these older sedimentary rocks?
So in these ancient sedimentary rocks, the problem is when they get that old, getting them unmetamorphosed is very difficult. There are some... The oldest sedimentary rocks are up in Greenland, and they've been squeezed and squished until pretty much they're metamorphic. You know, any field geologist would call them metamorphic rocks, but an early life paleontologist would say, no, they're definitely sedimentary rocks. They've just been squeezed a bit. But what you don't have body fossils, you don't have organic fossils in those kinds of things, because they've just been cooked so much. In that case, you are looking at the chemical signals of life and the isotopic signals of life, and some scientists claim that there is signs of life in those kinds of rocks, but then again you are still lacking your full complement of evidence to say that life is there. Okay, you've got chemicals, you've got isotopes, but you don't have any body fossil evidence, and without that body fossil evidence you can always try and come up, you know, you can always assume a physical origin for these signals, unless you have absolutely everything tying together to call it life.
So I'm just trying to establish if, in our hunt for the oldest life, the geology, the kind of rocks and what state they're in, is the limiting factor for how far we can go back.
Yeah, that's pretty much the truth of it, because we're finding preservation of fossils pretty much everywhere we have the right kinds of rocks, and the problem is finding the right kinds of rocks. There's a reason why this field is sometimes called geobiology, because the further back you go, the more you're actually looking at the geology, and rather than just looking at the biology. Modern day paleontologists look at dinosaurs and things like that, don't know that much about the rocks that they're coming from, because that's not the important thing. The important thing is the fossil and understanding, you know, how all the bones go together and how it all worked. But when you go further back, the information you're dealing with is actually geological, and you're looking at that ancient geological environment and how the potential presence of biology could have or would have affected it.
So what was the impact of the origin of life on the rest of the planet? I know you said about cyanobacteria and chlorophyll and chloroplasts. So it must have had a massive impact on the atmosphere and just...
Absolutely, yeah. There's a lot of opinion rattling around that says that without life, the Earth wouldn't be habitable anymore. That sort of doesn't make sense, but when you think about it, Earth would have gone the way of Mars, if possibly a bit slower, but if life hadn't arisen on Earth when it did, a lot of things, a lot of physical processes would have been a lot more intense. So we've got life constantly replenishing the amount of water vapor, the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere. So without life, the composition of the atmosphere would have been completely different. It changed around 2.5 billion years ago when photosynthesizing organisms really took off. And it went from a very reducing, nasty, hellish, methane-rich atmosphere to something that we would consider today a lot more habitable, with plenty of oxygen for our oxygen-breathing organisms like you and me. But the life that started 3.5 billion years ago wouldn't think that today's Earth was very habitable at all, because that early life made use of the methane and the kind of hellish gases that you had in the atmosphere before. So as the Earth has changed, the biology has had to change along with it. Life is also very good at keeping things nice for itself. This is kind of the Gaia idea, the idea of a planet that can buffer any major changes and keep the physical conditions within things that are habitable for it. So the ranges of temperature on the Earth today are very small compared to the other planets in our solar system. And that's largely because of the way that life reacts to those physical changes. So when we have global warming and when we have increases in temperature, then you get increases in plant growth and increases of just life in general. So that will then, in a simple scenario, that increase in plant growth will produce an increase in drawdown of carbon dioxide, which will then hopefully cause a negative feedback and then ultimate cooling of the planet. So you don't get these kind of runaway greenhouse environments, and everything's kept very much habitable for the life on Earth. So, yeah, that was really garbled, sorry.
Do you think then that it may be possible to terraform Mars?
That's another one of these sexy ideas. Everybody has got this lovely idea of people living in harmony on the surface of Mars with a nice sort of oxygen-rich atmosphere. The truth of it is, yes, it would be possible, but not... The actual process of terraforming Mars would take at least 1,000 years. So if you can get any kind of government body to fund something, a project that's going to last for 1,000 years, I wish you the best of luck. But the plants and algae and things like that that will bring about this terraforming process work very slowly. On the Earth, it's worked over billions of years. So we've been patient and waited billions of years to get it how we like it. We could make it more accelerated on Mars, but even so, it would still be thousands of years before it would be a habitable environment.
How are these climate changes and feedbacks all recorded in the geological record? Or is it in the fossils that we get?
Well, the fossils can tell us what's happening in life. They're useful for that, and interpreting them is a bit of a challenge. But you can use the fossil record to to understand when these photosynthesizers appeared and when eukaryotes appeared. But really, we're looking at the geological record and just the rock record. We start to see when photosynthesizers appeared, our best evidence for when photosynthesizers appeared is when we start to see oxygenation of minerals in the fossil in the rock record. So you see the appearance of banded iron formations, or BIFs, and they are huge striped deposits of iron which have become oxidized, and when things become oxidized they turn red. So these huge striped red deposits, and that was really marking the beginning of oxygenation within the atmosphere and ocean, because you have, if you start with a reducing ocean and reducing atmosphere with no oxygen in it at all, if you've got something that suddenly starts to produce oxygen, it will start to fill up the atmosphere and diffuse into the ocean. And all of these minerals that were rattling around before in their reduced state, so reduced iron, Fe2+, is sort of rolling around in the ocean, minding its own business, and suddenly this oxygen, which is unsurprisingly a very powerful oxidant, comes along and binds to the iron, and it forms this iron oxide that becomes deposited in these huge red banded deposits. So around 2.5 billion years ago, and it went on for a few hundred million years, you see the formation of these banded iron formations where iron is just getting attacked by the oxygen that's getting pumped into the atmosphere by something, we presume photosynthesizing organisms. So this iron's being attacked by the oxygen and it's getting deposited. So that is the first sign that oxygen has appeared, because we don't see it before, we just see reduced iron, and afterwards we see this this red oxidized iron. So after the BIFs had formed, after all of the oxygen had sort of saturated all of the iron that was rattling around in the ocean, it started to fill up the ocean and then fill up the atmosphere. And then we start to see oxygenation of terrestrial environments and the formation of sort of red sandstone beds, like the old red sandstone or the new red sandstone in the Phanerozoic. They are products, they're red because they're exposed to the oxygenating atmosphere that you have in the Phanerozoic. And you start to see these kind of red beds in the Precambrian just after the BIFs start to form, because the atmosphere is now oxygenating and it can turn these sandstones red where they once would have been green from the reduced iron.
So can we infer then that Mars actually had a lot of oxygen at one point because all of its rocks are red?
Possibly so. I don't know about the formation of Mars specifically and geologically. We know that Mars is red, and so it must have oxygenated iron. But it's all red, and it's always been red. So we can't really infer much about the changes of oxygenation on Mars. So if we found layers with green and then red, then we could say that a similar process happened on Mars, but we don't. So it's probably something about the actual formation of the Martian rocks in the first instance. What is interesting about Mars is that it's got different kinds of minerals, and this is what Curiosity is going to look for. It's got different kinds of minerals that were deposited by, we believe, water. And those are telling us things about the changing composition of the presumed ancient Martian ocean. So Curiosity is going to go and look, and it's going to go and analyze some of these clays and evaporites and all of these sorts of minerals that we can compare with Earth's minerals, and try to work out what happened on Mars and how the chemistry changed and how it ended up losing its ocean, and whether life had some kind of modifying effect before that all happened.
Curiosity is also known as the Mars Science Laboratory. So how is it actually, what is the physical processes that it's going to be doing to ascertain how habitable Mars once was?
So Curiosity is a really exciting program, and we're so pleased that it didn't smash itself into pieces on the surface of Mars during its landing. It got all the press because of its really ambitious landing with the Sky Crane, but what I personally think is more exciting is the amazing suite of instruments that they've got on board. So for the because they've landed it in this ridiculously audacious way, they've managed to ship a greater weight of instruments than they've ever done before. So this rover is almost 10 times bigger than anything they've ever landed on the surface of Mars before. And it's got a nuclear plutonium reactor that can power the instruments and keep everything warm enough to work. And it's got a whole suite of different things that it can look at the rocks and look at the organic compounds on Mars all in tandem. So one of the coolest things, I think, is the mast cam and the chem cam. So these are on the head on top of the mast. They're going to use lasers with the chem cam to shoot something from about 7 feet away with a laser and vaporize the rock in front of it. So you've then got kind of a rock plasma in the air. It can then scan that rock plasma for the light spectrum, the visible and invisible light spectrum, and use that to tell what is in that rock. So it actually saves driving right up to a rock and drilling it. So we can just shoot things with a laser from a distance and go, that looks interesting, that looks interesting, let's go over there and then go over there, and oh no, that doesn't look interesting. So the chem cam is going to really help us to pinpoint what's going to be a good sort of way to look at the rocks, and really is going to give us a quick characterization of which rocks are going to be the most interesting to look at. So we should be getting some really exciting data quicker as a result of ChemCam. And sort of in combination with that, there's an instrument that they've developed here at NASA Ames called ChemIN. And it is basically, it's going to take samples, powdered samples of rock. So they'll drill down into the rock and then deliver it into the ChemIN instrument. And it will produce a spectrum of that rock. Using X-ray diffraction, so they'll fire X-rays at it and the powder will scatter and produce a pattern which will be particularly characteristic of the chemical makeup of that rock. So that is pretty much unrivaled characterization of geology. We can only just begin to do that in the field on Earth, and we've already sent it to Mars, which is pretty exciting. So we can drive up to a rock, drill it, and put it into ChemIN, and after a few hours, we can turn around and go, yep, this is a potassium sulfate or something like that. And that instantly allow us to map on a very, very fine scale exactly how the minerals are changing. So that's really exciting. And so ChemIN's working in combination with another instrument called SAM that I don't know much about, but that one's going to be sniffing the air and sniffing the powder that comes out of the ChemIN instrument as well, and actually looking for organic compounds like some of the Martian rovers have done before, but with much higher resolution and much more conclusive results, hopefully. So there's this really exciting dry chemistry setup that is absolutely unrivaled on any kind of space mission, and also barely rivaled in field missions on Earth. So we're going to be able to tell a lot from Curiosity. Whether it will find life for us, we don't know, because obviously it depends on whether life's there. But it's going to be able to find some really cool geology, and it's really going to help us to pull apart what happened to Mars. That's one of the great things about where it's landed, because it's landed in Gale Crater, which is a 5 kilometer deep depression from the top from the bottom to the top of the mountain, Mount Sharp. And that is basically running through the whole stratigraphy of Mars as it's changed, as, you know, there's a watery phase and volcanic phases. So it's really going to tell us a lot about the geological evolution and hopefully the geobiological evolution of Mars.
Will it be able to tell us everything, though? I mean, is it basically going to replace any manned Mars missions?
I don't think anything can replace a Mars mission. Anything can replace an actual man on the surface of Mars, not least because we are humans and we can never escape the wonder of discovery and exploration. So we won't say that we've been to Mars until we land a human on Mars. As to science, I think this is really the most technologically advanced setup we've ever sent, but it's using techniques that would have been absolutely unheard of 20 years ago, So in 20 years' time, maybe we could send something even more advanced to the surface of Mars that is robotic. But as it is, everybody would always want to put a man on Mars. And maybe that's foreseeable. Maybe that's achievable in the foreseeable future. One of the other missions that they're trying to push for following this and any other robotic exploration of Mars is a controlled sample return mission that will actually fly to Mars, pick up a sample of Martian rock that we know where it's come from, and then bring it back to Earth so that we can run as many tests as we like. That's the problem with a rover. You can only fit so much on a rover. And yeah, we've put more on a rover than we've ever done before, but you know, you can't put an entire wet chemistry lab, and you can't put a bunch of field geologists that each have a specific piece of information that might be critical all on a rover. So that's the argument for either a sample return mission or a manned mission.
And do you think we'll ever find evidence for life on Mars or anywhere else in the solar system?
I hope so. It will keep me in a job, but I think everybody's hopeful that they will. We wouldn't be mounting all of these expensive and audacious experiments if we didn't have that hope. The odds are even, but probably against it. The rest of the solar system is pretty uninhabitable. There's not liquid water in abundance anywhere in the solar system, and anywhere that you do find it, it's in hard to reach places or places that we would consider difficult for life to thrive. So we might find life on Mars, but it will be in very small refuges where life has managed to sort of keep to a little pool of water and stick to that over millions or billions of years. The problem with Mars is that it's heavily irradiated. You have these kind of death rays shooting the surface. So anything that lives on Mars is going to have to survive that. You know, it's going to have to survive this kind of constant bombardment of cosmic rays. We might find fossils from the time that it was more habitable, but that will obviously depend on the geological evolution of the planet as well. We might find life somewhere else in the solar system, but it would be somewhat different to life on Earth because the conditions are simply so different. So some of the big best candidates are Europa around Jupiter, or Titan around Saturn, or the small moon of Enceladus around Saturn. These are all planetary bodies that are mostly made up of with a rocky core. And the tidal action, like the moon, our moon around the Earth, the tidal action around these moons around Jupiter is so strong that it can melt the ice deep inside the moon, and it can actually create an ocean. So Europa is thought to have an ocean under about 100 kilometres of ice. So if life needs water to exist, then there is water on Europa or in Europa. But there's also problems in that it's really, really cold. And it may not have light, and it's also going to be bombarded with radiation from Jupiter. So any life that we look at in the solar system is going to have to have these adaptations that make it very different to Earth life. But that's to be expected because it's had a very different history to Earth. I think we are certainly making every effort we can to find life in the solar system. And if it's there, we'll find it.
So what do you make of that, Joe?
Well, not a lot there, really, was there? Opening episode. We've only covered the origin of life, evolution of complex cells, self-sustaining nature of the Earth and life, and, of course, the hunt for E.T.
Well, I think it gets pretty interesting as well when life does actually get evolving.
I guess so. We've got a lot to cover, but NASA's going to be hard to top.
Yeah, well, we've got half a billion years' worth of evolution. Of natural evolution to cover, so we'll see what...
I think my favourite bit from that interview was the 10,000 people watching the Curiosity landing. That sounds like a fantastic festival for nerds. I want to be there on the next Mars landing.
Yeah, I think it would have been pretty good. I think there were a few sore heads in the morning.
Well, I'm looking forward to the next episode then. We've got a lot to cover, as you said, 500 million years, and a lot to squeeze in that time. But
well, hopefully we'll be going a long time, so...
All right, well, tune in next time for more Paleocast.
I say that. Tune in next time for more Paleocast.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society. Music was supplied by The Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at Paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.